What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Where is it? Where's the brick?
The brick is gone.
All right, you caught me. I took the brick, but only to have it polished up in time for us to announce our 2012 Golden Brick nominees. 8 overlooked, underappreciated films we humbly submit for your closer consideration.
The end-of-year onslaught begins, plus an unexpected journey with The Hobbit and an early review of Zero Dark Thirty, all ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM12.
And by MoviePass. See unlimited movies in theaters nationwide for a flat monthly subscription rate. It's by invitation only, so you've got an exclusive chance to sign up now through our affiliate program by going to MoviePass.com/FilmSpotting. You'll also get $10 off your second month, and you can give gift subscriptions for this holiday season. They're available in 1 month, 3 month, and 1 year packages. That's MoviePass.com/FilmSpotting to sign up now. You're listening to Film Spotting. Later in the show, we'll reveal the 8 finalists for the coveted Film Spotting Golden Brick and wallow in the Shire with The Hobbit.
But first, it's Chastain, Jessica Chastain, in Catherine Bigelow's real-world take on the espionage game, Zero Dark Thirty.
We're spending billions of dollars. We are still no closer to defeating our enemy.
20 detainees recognize that photo.
No birth certificate, no cell phone, you guys are ghosts.
He's right in the inner circle.
The whole world's gonna want in on this.
I want targets.
Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden?
Oh my God, is that what I think it is?
Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden?
Depending on your age, you either experienced the where were you moment when President Kennedy was assassinated firsthand, or likely heard an account from a grandparent or parent, as I did. My dad used to tell the story of starting to hear the buzz going around recess that Kennedy's been shot and wondering who would possibly want to kill the gym teacher, Mr. Kennedy. From 2001 to 2011, we experienced two unforgettable generation-defining moments, the September 11th terrorist attacks and the killing of Osama bin Laden. These moments provide the framing for the new thriller from the director and screenwriting team behind The Hurt Locker, Catherine Bigelow and Mark Bull. Bigelow and Bull bring us along on SEAL Team 6's mission to invade bin Laden's Pakistani compound and terminate him, but not before taking us through the 10-year manhunt step by painstaking step. Josh, right now every conversation going on about Zero Dark Thirty is focusing on its depiction of torture in the process to uncover bin Laden's whereabouts. It's an important topic, and one I'm sure we'll get to, but let's ease our way into this a bit. A lot of this film, true to the intelligence-gathering process, or so I imagine it, is devoted to watching people talking, or watching other people talking on tapes, or driving around in an SUV hoping to watch someone talking on the phone. It's clearly tedious and soul-crushing work, which comes to be reflected in the drained, gaunt face of the film's heroine, a CIA researcher named Maya, played by Jessica Chastain. But did you find anything tedious and soul-crushing about watching her work?
Not at all. And this is probably the fourth, maybe fifth, nearly three-hour movie we've seen in the last couple of weeks. It's just that time of year, and I would say that this film flew by more quickly than any of them. At least it did for me. Now, that on its own is not something worthy of praise, just that you didn't get bored. But I think it is indicative of the smartness of the screenplay and the details Bull chooses to focus on and give us, and how crucial they are, even though they may come from mundane sources. and also Bigelow's direction. I mean, she's very judicious on what scenes to give us snippets of and what ones to blow out into larger set pieces to keep the suspense going or percolating here, even though we also get a sense of how long of a journey this has been. But for me, the reason this movie really worked was Chastain. And I had an odd relationship with her performance because it was so jarring at first to see her in this type of film. This is a spy movie full of blustery macho men, as most spy movies are. And here we have the ethereal mother figure we've gotten used to from The Tree of Life or Take Shelter. And she still looks like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she hasn't gone Angelina Jolie and tried to match the part in terms of changing her physicality or her attitude. She still uses the features and attributes we're familiar with and puts them in this story. And really the question that she forces us to ask two questions. First of all, is this a case of really bad miscasting? Because initially you could think that. Or secondly, and this is what I think the movie is doing, what if the smartest person in the room among all these top-level CIA folks and all of these men, there are a few other women, but mostly men, is this waifish, quiet, young woman? And I think that made the movie really interesting to me and rooted me in her journey as well as the larger journey that it takes us through. So what at first made me very unsure, a performance that I wasn't quite sure what to do with, by the time the movie was over and I had some time to process it, it struck me as one of the best performances of the year.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that and on the film as a whole. I agree. I think there are some very subtle, very interesting comments being made here on gender politics, without a doubt. And I'm with you in terms of the larger picture as well. This film was 157 minutes long, with only 20 to 25 being what we would consider action scenes. That's at the end. And not only am I with you in being never bored, I'm not sure I blinked the entire time. That's how focused in from the opening harrowing sounds that we get at the beginning of this film with just black on the screen of World Trade Center callers during the 9/11 attack, which is where this manhunt ostensibly begins. It makes sense that that's where they would start. On to that final frame, I was hooked by this film. And of course, you know how it's going to end. That doesn't matter. It's still just as suspenseful as any other type of action thriller, if not more so, because its focus is on the process. It's all about how we got to that point, how we found the world's most notorious needle in a haystack, as Donald Rumsfeld once referred to bin Laden. And along the way, by focusing on the procedure, what we get, without being heavy-handed at all, is a fascinating human drama, a fascinating espionage drama, a fascinating political drama that has my favorite acting ensemble of the year in it. Every scene seems to offer you a new, familiar face to enjoy. Jennifer Ely, Mark Strong, Kyle Chandler. Apparently, after Argo and Zero Dark Thirty, if you need someone to run your office, he's your guy. Edgar Ramirez, James Gandolfini, Stephen Delane, Joel Edgerton, Chris Pratt. There's even a Mark Duplass sighting in this movie. And I like Jason Clarke here.
I was going to say, you haven't even mentioned my favorite performance yet besides Chastain's.
Yeah, he's a really interesting character and it's a good performance. And he does play a major role, especially at the beginning of the film. He's one of the first characters we meet. And of course, there's Chastain.
If you really want to protect the homeland, you need to get bin Laden.
This guy never met bin Laden.
You just want me to nail some low-level mullah crackadola so you can check that box on your resume that says while you were in Pakistan, you got a real terrorist. But the truth is, you don't understand Pakistan, and you don't know Al-Qaeda. Either give me the team I need to follow this lead, or the other thing you're going to have on your resume is being the first station chief to be called before a congressional committee for subverting the efforts to capture or kill bin Laden.
I'm with you. I think she's a marvel here. And you're right that there's something slightly off about some of those lines of dialogue coming from her mouth. Some of the things she says don't feel like they would match her persona, what she brings in terms of Chastain's natural character, but they're never for a second laughable. You never question her conviction watching this film. I think she hits every single note, and this role asks her to hit a lot of different notes. And maybe my only criticism of the film is actually that it's such an atypical, meticulous procedural. It plays things so matter-of-factly that it's a little bit jarring when Maya becomes a little bit too much of a conventional Hollywood hero, I think. Sometimes she's the lone voice of reason who makes that dramatic, impassioned speech and says exactly the right thing and even has to dress down her supervisor at one point. But that's a thrilling scene, and she makes it thrilling with her performance and the writing, of course.
I think what's happening there there in the lines where you said you're not sure if she sells it, that's what threw me off too, because it was like she was given Clint Eastwood dialogue, and this is Jessica Chastain.
I think she sells it, don't get me wrong, but first when you hear it.
I think the awkwardness is intentional, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And what she's doing is making us realize how, because Maya does not fit the typical role here, she's trying on that role in some of these early scenes. Mm-hmm. She's trying to sound like these guys. And the point is, it doesn't sound natural from her, and it's maybe not going to work. Yet, by her own gifts and intelligence and the deducing she does from the facts they get, that's how she's going to get ahead of everyone else and figures out what's really going on here. So it's really a matter of watching her try on these different roles and getting comfortable herself. And I'm talking about Maya here. Mm-hmm. Within the spy agency, that's part of the drama that's going on.
I agree. And I think for me, the construction and craftsmanship of the film aside, a microcosm of what I think Bull and Bigelow do so well here comes in the relationship between Jessica Chastain and one of her coworkers, played by Jennifer Ely. Right from the start, it's a complicated relationship. There are two women, I think the only two women in the room. One's a vet. One's obviously the rookie, that's Chastain, who's new here. She kind of plays it like she knows everything, that she's got some of the right answers, maybe is wiser than Jennifer Ely is. And there's some tension there that I think you sense early on. But wisely, they don't ratchet that into any kind of rivalry, which is somewhere we've seen this type of storyline, this type of subplot go so many times before. Nor do they ever exploit it into something totally sentimental like they easily could have. They become friends, though. And we get to see them through that friendship with their analyst hats off a little bit. It humanizes both of them, especially Maya, and I think that's crucial, where you get to see that rough exterior crack a little bit. And the relationship doesn't take up a huge part of the film, but I'll just say without spoiling anything or trying not to spoil anything, it ends up giving Maya a very important personal connection to this larger cause. It's not just about doing her job or about getting revenge for the American people or just about the victims of 9/11 as some kind of abstraction, something that maybe she doesn't have a direct connection to. Getting bin Laden becomes the payoff for everyone who sacrificed and everyone who was sacrificed along the way. And so the SEAL Team 6 mission at the end takes on so much more resonance, I think, and we're even more riveted because on its face, yes, it's thrilling and intense, but also because we're so invested. We've seen all these steps and we've seen all those sacrifices.
Yeah, that relationship helps to make it personal, and you do need that a little bit. What I liked about Zero Dark Thirty is it also didn't go overboard on that and give us all sorts of extraneous details about these people's family lives.
No backstory.
No backstory. You just get little hints of the fact that they don't really have a family life, but also you see how the coworkers eventually come to bond because these are the only other people they can communicate with at all, let alone connect with.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film, Zero Dark Thirty. In fact, at this point, Josh, it's so new, it's not out yet. It doesn't open until December 19th in select cities. And then January 4th, I believe, is the target date for a Chicago release. But fortunately, we're free to give it an early review here on the show. I do want to make one comment about the score of the film, because it's not, for me, maybe one of the top five or six things that I enjoyed about this film. But since I have a tendency here to single out scores only when they don't work for me and be critical here on the show, I feel like I have to make mention of Alexandre Desplat here and what he does, because like the film, I really do think the music is very effective here. It's workmanlike. It does its job, gives you some of these ominous tones, but it just heightens the tension and doesn't underline or overpower anything. So I do want to give credit to this score, which I think is one of the better scores of the year. But I suppose since it has blown up into a bit of a controversy this past week, just over the past couple of days here, actually, we have to address the issue of torture as it relates to this film. It's maybe by now, as people are listening, blown over enough to the point where listeners are hoping we don't waste time on it, or they're thinking we absolutely have to get into it, and that's what we're going to do. It was initiated mainly by a Glenn Greenwald article in The Guardian that basically suggested the movie goes out of its way to validate torture as a means for gathering intelligence, and that it glorifies it by suggesting it was crucial in leading us to bin Laden. Unfortunately, Mr. Greenwald missed the chance to have a truly enlightening and, in my opinion, frankly, accurate article by tackling the film before seeing the film, claiming that he didn't really have to because he wasn't reviewing it. So what's your take on the torture controversy in Zero Dark Thirty?
I'd almost rather not address it if that's where it stemmed from. I mean, anytime there's an argument coming from someone who hasn't seen the film is ridiculous. But I do think it's worth talking about torture in general. And I'll just say my perception of it from the movie and not knowing anything of this controversy going on, I had no assumption that the movie was endorsing torture at all. Now, I'm not saying it was also some sort of condemnation of the techniques that the U.S. may have used in trying to find out some of this information in the search for bin Laden. What I appreciated about the film, and the first probably 25, maybe 30 minutes, are intense depictions of torture sessions at the hands of CIA operatives.
Right.
So this is in our face. And what it did for me is set up the entire rest of the film so that it haunted the film.
Right.
So every time any sort of headway was made because of information that was gotten from one of those torture sessions, what I was asking myself was, okay, was that worth it? Was that worth it? Was that worth it? And this movie was so disturbing in its depiction of torture for me personally that when we got to the end and we see the assassination of bin Laden, which I don't think the movie plays as a rah-rah scene, but
no.
Audiences could take it that way. Some people will take it that way. Even if you do, it's my feeling that the earlier depictions of torture are going to make that moment ring a little hollow because you're still going to be asking yourself, okay, we, the U.S. got them, but was it worth all of that stuff that people endured before to get this guy? I mean, I think if we're going to have a serious discussion about torture and the use of torture by nation states in the name of self-defense, you're going to have to face the fact of, would we do it if it does make us safer?
Mm-hmm.
It's no good to have a movie just say it's terrible and it doesn't make us safer. Why are we even bothering to do this? The real issue is going to come in answering, okay, it will make you safer. Would you still condone it? And Zero Dark Thirty makes us ask those tough questions.
Well, let me just expand on that because I think you've said it very well. There's no doubt that if you want to reduce this to its most black and white, the movie does depict scenes of torture that ultimately lead to some information being disclosed that factors into finding bin Laden. So if you don't believe that happened, as some have claimed it didn't, or you just reject any notion that torture could ever lead to usable intelligence, then I suppose you can just write this film off if you want to. Maybe you should just not bother seeing it then if that's the perspective you're going to bring to it. But to that, I'd say first, obviously Bohl and Bigelow's research revealed otherwise. And that's what they've said so far. They got this from firsthand accounts. This is the approach they're taking. Second, though, as you noted, Josh, you have to look at how the movie actually portrays torture. And I wonder if Greenwald had done this, whether his article would have come to fruition, because I think he would have found too many contradictions in his hypothesis. It's graphic and ugly. And it's not just ugly, it's repellent. It's abhorrent. We see this step-by-step process, too. We're forced to watch a man get waterboarded, essentially in real time. And there's no escape for us as the audience. The filmmakers say, here it is, we did it, and we're not going to let you know that torture went on and just get to gloss over it. We're going to have to see it, and we're going to have to wrestle with it. We're going to have to wrestle with that question you posed, whether that type of inhumanity is okay as long as you're happy with the end result. So they give us that challenge. I do think it would help Bohl and Bigelow in these conversations if in interviews they'd stop using the word journalistic when they talk about their approach, because that suggests total authenticity and accuracy, something which is obviously impossible when they're condensing a 10-year process into a 2.5-hour film.
It's also something that's hard for a documentary, let alone a fictional drama.
Exactly. So this is based on a true story. Like all films based on a true story, you know they took some license. And it's not as if the film is presented as a United 93 type account with handheld cameras giving it that you're really there type of feel. But where it is journalistic, and I think this is where some of this issue comes from, is in its lack of judgment. Nobody ever condemns the acts of torture. No one ever steps up as a voice of reason and questions whether what they're doing is right or wrong. So in that sense, it's as if the filmmakers are just reporting it. There's no scene where Maya asks why. We do see her recoil from it in horror early in the film. I think that's worth noting.
And that's a very interesting character development.
Absolutely. She comes around as she gets deeper into this process. But there isn't that scene where she questions it and someone says, nope, this is the way we do it. And she begrudgingly goes along. She does go along. And I love that about this movie, because even one scene like that for me, Josh, one scene where someone questions it in that way, in a really kind of heavy-handed, moralizing way, would actually just serve to assuage our guilty consciences. We'd get to wave the flag in the end and say, we're the badasses who got bin Laden, and we're moral badasses too. Sure, we did some bad things, but we feel really bad about it.
I think this movie is shoving it in American audiences' faces in a lot of ways. Not in a heavy way,
no.
but in the exact way you're talking about. And as we're talking here, it just occurred to me, I love the final shot of this movie.
I know.
And I'm not going to say what it is, but Maya's in it. And I'm realizing now, this is what she's probably thinking about. Some of these very things we're
I think we can read into it then.
Exactly. And so, yeah, that just seems like a ludicrous response to the film, but it's not even really a response to the film if you hadn't seen it
That's
yet.
True, but I just love the fact that they don't let us clear our consciences that easily. And there's a notable scene where President Obama, I think he's been elected at this point when we're seeing it in the film, and he's on TV during an interview. It's just in the background of another scene with Chastain and a coworker, and he says the U.S. doesn't torture. That scene is there, it would seem to me, to draw our attention to that moral hypocrisy. We've seen up to this point evidence that clearly contradicts what the president said. Why would that be there except to draw our attention again to that bit of hypocrisy?
And let me get back to the performance by Jason Clarke, because I think it ties into this. He, as you mentioned, is one of the first people we see, and he's a lead CIA interrogator. So we meet him with wild hair. He's disheveled, and he's torturing this suspect, mm-hmm. this detainee. And this is a creepy, creepy performance, because his tactic is to be insidiously intimate with these captives. If you notice, as much violence and pain he's inflicting on them, he also does a lot of consoling and caressing. And watching this whole process was just sickening.
It was.
At the same time, this Clark character is a very sympathetic guy outside of the torture chamber, because he kind of takes Maya under his wing and guides her a little bit. He also makes a lot of sense when he talks about
policy. He's very
policy.
Practical.
He's very practical and the approaches. And again, where the movie shoves it to us a little bit is later in the film, he disappears for a while. Later in the film, we come across him again back in Washington, and notice how cleaned up he is.
Yeah.
His hair is shorter. It's combed. He's in a CIA suit. And if you think about that transition, that again is emphasizing the hypocrisy by now we have this clean-cut guy in Washington who would never do that sort of mm-hmm. thing. Never mind what we saw earlier.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're spending a couple more minutes on the upcoming film, Zero Dark Thirty, specifically its depiction of torture, which has become a bit of a lightning rod issue this week. And I hate to be redundant because, again, you said it very well, but I want to emphasize what happens in not only the final scene, but the scene just before the final moments of this film. I won't get into details. I don't want to ruin the moment for anybody by getting into specifics, but I think it's impossible to watch Jessica Chastain's final couple moments and not see the filmmakers as recognizing the personal and moral costs to this manhunt. There is no rah-rah jingoism about the film's denouement. And I'm with you, Josh, that there's something actually a bit empty about it. There's something small in these final moments, even in the moment that really should be the moment of glory where we got the body. It doesn't play that way at all. We end up asking that question, I think, or at least the movie allows us to ask the question rather than force on us, was it worth it? Was the human cost here and the moral cost of everything we see unfold over these 10 years, was it worth getting that one body? And I really respect the film for respecting us enough to present it that way.
In addition to that layer you're talking about, that final sequence of the raid on the compound itself is pretty impressive because it's working at a different level than we're used to. It is the main section of action in the film, as you mentioned, but it doesn't play like an action climax. It somehow deflates the heroism without losing the tension. And mm-hmm. I don't mean that it's being critical of the SEAL soldiers. It's very respectful of the risk they're taking and the skills they have. Yet it deflates the heroism. It still has the tension. It's a matter of fact sequence.
Yeah.
What astonished me about it is how much time it took. And I'm assuming this is very much like reality because it makes more sense than some sort of James Bond attack where you're in and out. But how much time it took for them to get from one door to the other, to bust through one door, to get to the other, to clear a room. It's very attentive to all those details. And while it's unlike any other action movie we usually get in terms of the bang, bang, bang motion, it's somehow even more tense.
I agree with you. I think it's because they have that attention to detail. They show the intricacy of the process. And that is why you do come to respect them even more, because you see exactly what goes into this undertaking. It's so much more complicated than we even imagine. We will put a few links in the show notes at filmspotting.net if you're curious more about this issue of torture, as it's depicted in Zero Dark Thirty, because I read two articles that were just posted earlier this morning, Josh, that I think really do offer the best rebuttals I've seen to Glenn Greenwald. One is from Emily Bazelon of Slate, and one is from Spencer Ackerman over at Wired. Just really smart stuff, and I won't say anything more about it except to link to them if you want to check them out.
Can we not link to the Guardian piece, please?
I'm afraid we have to, Josh.
I don't like the idea of linking to anything from someone who hasn't seen a film and is commenting on the film.
Well, in fairness to Mr. Greenwald, I know there are a lot of people out there who really respect his work, and he's clearly a very smart man and talented writer. I do think he had a very misguided approach to this particular piece. As we said, this was a very early review. Zero Dark Thirty opens in limited release on Wednesday, December 19th, and it's set for a Chicago release date as of right now on January 4th. We'll let you know if anything changes there. If you see Zero Dark Thirty and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a voicemail at 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
You get not one, but two British accents up next in Massacre Theater. Plus, is the fact that Adam came to the studio barefoot a sign that he's embraced all things Hobbit? Stay with us.
I stood alone upon the platform in vain. The Puerto Ricans, they were playing this sauce in the rain. With open doors and manual locks and fast food parking lots, I headed west, I was a man on the moon. New York had lied to me, I needed the truth. Oh, I need somebody, I needed someone I could trust. And I don't gamble, but if I did, I would bet on it. Like the Dead Sea, you told me I was like the Dead Sea. You'll never sink when you were with me. Oh Lord, like the Dead Sea.
Hey folks, we wanted to take a minute to thank this week's sponsor again. That's Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether that's for your website, multimedia presentation, or an advertisement you may be working on. Whatever the project is, you can choose from over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. Most of them come in HD, and they source video clips from around the world and make them available at your fingertips. Shutterstock adds 10,000 video clips each week, so you'll always find something new. And Josh, we have heard from many Film Spotting listeners who are regular Shutterstock users, and hopefully we can turn a few more on.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM12 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM12. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Film Spotting.
Red Sox fan.
Mm-hmm. Red Sox, Pats, Celts. Yes.
Now, why would you go and do that and ruin what I thought was a pretty good thing we got going on here?
What makes you think this is a good thing?
I'm a little out of practice, but yeah, it seems like it's going pretty well. You're smiling, huh. I'm laughing.
Yeah. Something tells me you don't laugh very much.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's a scene from the new film, The Fitzgerald Family Christmas, written and directed by friend of the show, Ed Burns. Ed also plays a major role in the movie. It's got a great ensemble cast, and Ed is going to be here in Chicago next week for an event at the City Winery. He's going to be with the City Winery founder, Michael Dorf, to pair together. Check out this hoity-toity event, Josh. They're going to pair different wines with different clips from Ed's movies.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah. It sounds like fun, actually. And he's going to break them down and do a Q&A with the crowd there as well. That's Tuesday, December 18th at 8 p.m. And Film Spotting has 5 free passes to give away to that event. The contest is simple. Just send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and tell us what wine you would pair with your favorite film. That's all you got to do.
Now, Ed's made a lot of good films, but this also strikes me as a very clever way of winning over your audience.
Exactly.
I mean, they're going to come away from this thing thinking, man, I didn't realize his movies were this great.
You're right.
I like that.
Yeah, I like it too. It's very, very clever. And hopefully you all have a chance to be there. We'll announce the winners on Monday, December 17th by sending you an email. Again, all you have to do to enter is email feedback@filmspotting.net. And we'll link to more information about the event in the notes for this show at our website, filmspotting.net. I suppose now is a good time, Josh, to transition from the good acting that you do see in the Fitzgerald Family Christmas to some really, really terrible acting.
That would be Massacre Theater.
Yeah.
Our chance to perform a scene, your chance to win a prize. Last show, we massacred this scene.
Hey, so what do you got coming up after this?
Nick, I got two movies right after yours. One, I play a rapist that Michelle Pfeiffer falls in love with. The other one, I play a kind of a sexy... serial killer that shacks up with Winona Ryder.
That's great.
Yeah. I'm not into that Hostess Twinkie shit.
Hostess Twinkie?
Hollywood shit, man. You know, it's all fluff. These are the kind of films I want to be doing.
Hey, thanks, man.
Hey.
I gotta say, I'm really glad you feel that way, and I'm excited to be working with you.
Yeah, me too. You're a great director, man. Your films are totally whack. You know, I'm going to be watching you, buddy, like a hawk. I want to learn from you, Nick. I'm going to pick your brain.
Good. Then you could pick my nose.
That was Steve Buscemi as director Nick Reeve and James LaGrosse as his star, Chad Palomino, in 1995's Living in Oblivion, written and directed by Tom DiCillo.
Nicholas Barner from New London, Connecticut, was one of the listeners who got the tie into last week's show. He says that according to Hollywood legend, it's based on director Tom DiCillo's experiences with Brad Pitt, the star of Killing Me Softly, while shooting Johnny Suede. That is indeed where we were going with
you had a lot of layers
tie-in.
Going on there.
There were some layers there, but very famously, though DiCillo has apparently denied it, the rumor has always been that Chad is really supposed to be Brad, and the difficult actor that you get in that film is actually based on Brad Pitt. Based on some early Brad Pitt performances, it wouldn't surprise me one bit to know that he was that actor.
Similarity,
you see,
huh?
Oh, you see some of those mannerisms and the energy, the abundance of energy, just wanting to try different things on the set.
So LaGrosse is kind of doing a Massacre Theater Brad Pitt, essentially.
I think he is.
There's another layer you have.
If you want to hear our review of Killing Them Softly and also our top five inept criminals from last week, you can hear that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. We also got a very funny email here from listener Jeff Haynes in Spencerport, New York.
I don't know, guys. On the one hand, I'm thinking this will be a record for fewest entries. Has anyone really seen this film? On the other hand, a movie about a no-budget movie? Sounds like something half the film spotting audience has first-hand experience with. So it might get more entries than I expect.
Jeff obviously is a regular listener. He knows our audience well, and yet... not many
entries there weren't, huh?
At all. Yeah, I'm afraid more people need to see Living in Oblivion. It's a very funny, very clever movie. And yes, it's going to be appreciated a little bit more by people who have probably tried to make a film, but I still think there is some universal appeal to that film. So definitely one I recommend. Why don't you reach into the film spotting hat? It's not very full this week, Josh, and pick out this week's winner.
We still have a winner. It's Matt Kelly from East Northport, New York.
Congratulations, Matt. Email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Because after Salome, we'll make another picture and another picture. You see, this is my life. It always will be. There's nothing else. Just us. And the camera.
Time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
Well, this is another one, Josh. I anticipate maybe not having that many entries. The tie-in to this week's show should be pretty obvious, and we're going to make it more obvious here in a moment with a hint, because we think a hint is needed.
Probably.
This is somewhat obscure. A blast.
I wouldn't call it an obscure film, but yeah, there you go.
Maybe even another hint will say it's a little bit of a nostalgia favorite, but the hint we'll give you is that the director of this movie was connected at one point to a project near and dear to the heart of the director who helmed the film we're going to talk about next.
All right, I think I followed you.
Does that work?
Yeah, I think that works.
Okay, I think we got it. I'm going to start it off, so you're going to give me the action.
All right, here we go. And action.
What is this place?
Here you enter the coils of the dragon. Here my power was born. Here all things are possible, and all things meet their opposing.
The future?
And the past.
Desire?
And regret.
Knowledge?
And oblivion.
Love.
Oh, yes.
And scene. I think we got that one.
Very white.
I think we got
very white at the end.
That's what happens.
And I want to say this because I know right now some of you are judging Josh and you're saying, hey, that's just his drunk guy voice.
What?
True. It's very similar to his drunk guy voice. But having watched this scene today, that's exactly what he sounds like.
I do watch the scenes.
You nailed it.
I try.
You really nailed this one, Josh. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, December 18th.
The drunk guy. Oh, man. Winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
My name is Dr. King Schultz. This is my valet, Django. And these are our horses, Tony and Fritz. Mr. Bennett, I've been led to believe that you are a gentleman and a businessman. And it is for these attributes we've ridden from Texas to Tennessee to parlay with you now.
Well, what if I was to say I don't like you? And I wouldn't sell you a tinker's damn. Now, what you got to say about that?
Mr. Bennett, I have 5,000 things I might say that could change your mind.
Well, come on inside and get yourself something cool to drink.
A scene there from Quentin Tarantino's upcoming film, Django Unchained, Christoph Waltz and Don Johnson there in that scene. And that gives us an opportunity to give you a little scheduling update. If you heard last week's show, you heard us mention that we were going to talk about Ganja and Hess, the sixth and final film in our Blaxploitation Marathon, a marathon that we've geared around Django Unchained. It's there to prepare us for that viewing experience. And we decided that with Zero Dark Thirty open for review and The Hobbit coming out, that we'd rather focus on those two movies, save Ganja and Hess, for our Django Unchained show. So that's going to be, as you called it, Josh, I love this, a very special Blaxploitation Christmas.
Yeah, well, I don't know about your house, but every Christmas Eve, we sit around the fire, have some hot cocoa, and watch Blackula.
Oh, and throw on Superfly or
exactly.
Instead of Elvis Christmas,
yeah,
whatever
there
it
you
takes,
go.
Right? So that should be fun. That may be a podcast-only show, but what you'll hear is a review of Django. You'll get our discussion of Ganja and Hess and our Blaxploitation Marathon Awards, where we give you our best picture, best actor, probably our best scene, and more. Right now, we're thinking of calling it the Mayfields after the great Superfly score
from
Curtis
that.
Mayfield. So unless someone out there has a better idea, you can feel free to send that in. But again, that's something that's going to come Christmas week. Next week on the show is going to be our top 10 films of 2012. This is the show where we get Michael Phillips here. We get Scott Tobias. We do our roundtable. We break down the year in cinema.
That is going to be a blast. And it's a month earlier this year.
Yeah,
so
it's at least three weeks earlier.
Really
then.
Cramming trying to get these in.
Yeah.
It's been intense.
I think actually I've made myself a little bit sick in the process.
I believe
it's been hard. And speaking of big events coming up, our live show is happening as we've been promoting it January 6th at Main Stage, and tickets are available now.
Nice.
Yeah. So if you want to get them, go to filmspotting.net or go to mainstage.com. You'll find links there. Michael Phillips will also be part of that. That's our 2012 blowout. So obviously we're not going to just focus on our top 10 favorite films, but we're going to talk about our favorite performances, our favorite opening scenes.
We'll be all over the place.
All over the place. It should be a great time, and we look forward to seeing many of you there, hopefully. Again, it's on a Sunday afternoon, so maybe that will fit into your schedules. And I'm looking forward to having the event at Main Stage. It's a fantastic venue. They've got another great event coming up I did want to promote for them on January 12th. For any of those Mystery Science Theater 3000 fans out there, the creator of MST3K, Joel Hodgson, is going to be performing his new show, Riffing Myself, there at Main Stage on the 12th, and they're offering a VIP package to that. So again, if you're an MST3K fan and want more information, we'll link to it in our show notes at filmspotting.net. Also there, you can click on the apps link and get information about how to hear our weekly bonus content. It's available for Film Spotting listeners who have our Android app or if you have our iPhone app. And this week, we're going to get to some of our responses to our recent Spielberg Spectacular. We talked about Close Encounters and Lincoln and shared our top five Spielberg scenes. And we got some really good feedback, including some great voicemails. One of them from a very insightful listener, Josh, who asked a provocative question, which is, what it really means when we call something Spielbergian.
Yeah.
And are there other directors out there that you can apply that kind of name to? By using their last name, it has sometimes a pejorative connotation to it and not a positive one, which seems to be the case when people use Spielbergian. It's very interesting.
Well, and we tossed that term around on that show quite a bit, too. I don't know if we used it in a negative way, but it does happen quite a bit. I saw that. I'm mulling it over. I'll hopefully have an answer for you by the time bonus content comes around.
What is it, Precious? What is it?
My name is Bilbo Baggins.
Bagginses. What is a Bagginses, Precious?
I'm a hobbit from the Shire.
Oh, we like goblinses, batses, and fishes, but we haven't tried hobbitses before. Is it soft? Is it juicy?
Now, keep your distance. I'll use this. If I have to.
Peter Jackson seems determined to test our tolerance for hobbits. Now, being a childhood fan of J.R.R. Tolkien's fantasy novels and a huge admirer of Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy, I can handle a lot of hobbit. So I was only mildly skeptical, and I was still fairly intrigued, actually, by Jackson's plans to turn Tolkien's single novel precursor to The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, into a three-movie saga of its own. It begins with The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, in which Bilbo Baggins, who's a relative of Rings hero Frodo. Keeping up with me here, Adam?
I am.
All right, good. Baggins joins Gandalf the Wizard and a company of dwarves on a quest to retrieve a treasure from a dragon. It's fair to say you weren't beside yourself with anticipation for this movie, Adam. Not that you actively dislike the Rings films. So I'm wondering if Jackson won you over with An Unexpected Journey. Did he convince you that this was a world worth revisiting? Or is there no way I'm going to get you next year to see the sequel, The Desolation of Smaug?
Oh, is that really the name?
That is the name.
No.
You haven't looked it up?
No.
In such excitement?
Wow, as if I needed even less to anticipate that film. You just told me the
subtitle alone puts you off.
Might us just play a game of riddles instead? I love games, Josh. Maybe we could just do that?
Hey, that's the best scene in the film.
Okay, well, we'll get there. We'll see if that's the case. I did truly go in with clear eyes and a full heart, also a runny nose and a stuffy head, but I certainly was not hoping to sit in misery for almost 3 hours, and I didn't sit in misery, but I'm just trying to make it clear that I went in with optimistic expectations for this movie. I wanted it to work. I wanted to be enchanted by it. I wanted to be entertained by it, maybe even moved by it. I wanted to wonder, when it was all over, why I never gave Tolkien another try, the same way I did when I saw Fellowship of the Ring for the first time back. When was that? 2001,
I believe. So, yeah.
That's how I felt when I saw that film. None of those wishes came true. And it's funny because I remember you saying this, and I know other listeners have said it, lots of people commenting on The Hobbit have said something along these lines, that you were excited for the movie, or at least anticipating it with some eagerness, but that you were worried about Jackson's decision to make it into three films instead of just one. And I never really understood why. We didn't talk about it that much, but just because of my ignorance of the source. I knew it was one book, but I thought, who knows, maybe there are ancillary mythologies or materials that Jackson would be justified in exploring and expanding. I was going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I didn't think it could be as simple as this is a bad idea because he's stretching one book out to three movies. And that may result in stretching everything to a point where any real dramatic narrative momentum is untenable. But I think that's what happened here, Josh, and I really look forward to hearing your take on the movie. My guess is hardcore Hobbit fans may appreciate how lovingly it dotes on introducing characters and showing us their worlds and all the time we get to spend with them, and maybe even how Jackson seems intent on underlining every significant line of dialogue that encapsulates the book and film's important themes, almost like he's winking at all the apostles out there. But I didn't need 10, 15 minutes with Radagast the Brown and his animals. And 20 minutes of riddles with Gollum, I can see the allure of it. I really can, especially to Lord of the Rings fans. But that sidetracked me, the long stay with the elves. They're like being a kid on an exciting trip to Disney World, but having to constantly stop at rest areas along the way to take in the scenery. I was distracted and eventually just disappointed with the film.
I wish I could argue with you more. I was really hoping this was the film where I could come to you and say, see, this is what I get excited about. This is
but
what I really appreciated. I don't have the ammunition here. I still enjoyed it. I still think it's a good film. It's not in the same class as the earlier films, One thing I do want to point out in terms of its length and the expansion, and you're right, that was a concern of mine because The Hobbit is a far slimmer volume. I think he managed to make that work here because he does draw on the sort of materials you're talking about. And from what I understand, I haven't read the appendices to The Lord of the Rings, but from what I understand, that's where a lot of this extra material comes from. And I think it's actually a good job of including the story of The Hobbit more closely in the narrative of The Lord of the Rings, in the world of The Lord of the Rings, so they all become one giant story in a way that the literature wasn't. So I actually found that to be okay for me. It is long. It does take its time. It does seem to go off with characters in other directions. But if we're all honest with ourselves, the Lord of the Rings films did that too. I don't think the pacing here is too far off. There is a distinction and there is a difference. And to me, it's that the narrative in The Hobbit is a slice of history in this world. And it's sort of a precursor to what is an end of the world crisis in The Lord of the Rings. And so the sense of urgency is necessarily lessened here. There's no way around that. And I felt it. It feels like a lesser film. The pacing feels lesser as well. And so this isn't the movie a Hobbit fan is going to take to a non-Hobbit fan and win them over. It's just not. I still think it's a good film, and I'm going to point to that Gollum section as why. This is an amazing combination of narrative, performance, technology, in that I at least was held enthralled, and maybe it's because I do treasure the book, and it's one of these sequences that I've imagined in my own head for so long, and to see it done well and expanded upon where there are little touches like Gollum's hand paddling slightly in the water to silently sneak up on Bilbo, things that I didn't think of before but are so right, and the way they sustain this sequence of dialogue, not really action, there's the threat of action, is pretty impressive to me. And I found that pretty amazing. And I also liked seeing Gandalf again. I mean, Ian McKellen's performance here is quite something in a role that could be corny. It could be over the top. He is given those direct lines you're talking about, but that's the kind of film this is. There isn't anything subtle. I'm also criticized for not appreciating a lack of subtlety. Mm-hmm. So let me hold this up as the example where these grand actorly pronouncements of themes, I think they work within this franchise. And I think Ian McKellen is really good at delivering them, but even better, his face is so great, and he acts with all of those wrinkles. Every crease seems to be doing something different, so that a little eyebrow lift or a glance, he can cast suspicion. He has tenderness, and he delivers in his choice of Bilbo Baggins, played by Martin Freeman, quite well, I think. Mm-hmm. He delivers that underlying theme that resonates through all of Tolkien's literature, at least in this world, that small creatures are capable of great things, and it's a joy for me to see that brought back to life. But I can't really offer you much of an argument where I say, how could you have had that experience? You're completely wrong, because I understand that experience.
A sense of urgency, also referred to here on Film Spotting as stakes, and they're lacking here. And one of the reasons I think they're lacking gets back to the main character, or who should be the main character, and it's Martin Freeman's Bilbo Baggins. I think he does a fine job. I'm with you on that in terms of his performance. But of course, The Hobbit, the story, isn't about this world. And The Hobbit, the movie, shouldn't be about simply bringing Tolkien's world to life. It's about watching a compelling story. The world comes along with the story, and the story here is about a reluctant warrior. It's about a homesick hobbit discovering his place in the world, about rising above his place in life, figuring out who he is. He doesn't feel like a main character, though, I would say, for most of this movie. It's not till about 60-65% of the way through that they finally start to really turn the focus on him. And I can understand that to some extent, because there are interesting dwarf characters, and Gandalf is a really fascinating character, and I like McKellen's performance. So I understand getting sidetracked a little bit, but I really feel like it loses its narrative focus and doesn't give us enough attention on Martin Freeman's character.
I think you're right there. I think that's completely fair, and that is probably one of the things you lose by stretching this across three films.
Mm-hmm.
At exactly the point you're talking about, pretty much the end of the movie, Bilbo does step forward and kind of make a decision of what sort of person he's going to be on this adventure. And I'd argue that last 20 minutes are pretty intense in terms of character development and action and the spectacle you get. That was reminiscent to me of the Lord of the Rings films. But it is a problem that it takes that long to get to that point.
This is Ocrist, the goblin cleaver, a famous blade forged by the high elves of the West. My kin, may it serve you well. And this is Glamdring, the foe hammer, sword of the King of Gondolin. These swords were made for the goblin wars of the first.
I wouldn't bother, laddie. Swords are named for the great deeds they do in war.
What are you saying? My sword hasn't seen battle.
No, actually, sure, it is a sword. More of a letter opener, really.
Let me ask you a question that's been bugging me, and that has to do with the presentation. We saw this at separate screenings, and mine was one of these 48 frame per second 3D screenings, which is the way Jackson intended to make the film, and the way he shot the film, and then it's projected at 48 frames per second as well. I had honestly forgotten this when I went in. That's the complete truth. I had forgotten it. I was just crossing my fingers we weren't going to get it in 3D. That's all I was worried about. Once they handed me the glasses, I thought, oh, well, all right, I'm seeing The Hobbit. I'll sit down and enjoy it. From the first second, something was off to me visually. And there were two elements to this. One, which I haven't heard talked about a lot, so maybe it was just me or just our particular screening, was that the action seemed sped up. Characters seem to be moving almost in fast motion. Not in every scene, but even in scenes where a character would pick up a cup. There's this big dinner at the beginning with all the dwarves in Bilbo's house. It would seem like they were picking up the cup too quickly. I found that very distracting. And there's also this look that 48 frames per second has that some people have described as daytime soap opera or British television. I believe it was Dana Stevens in her review on Slate described it really well and made sense to me in that there's almost too much realistic detail in that you notice these are sets in a way that you didn't
earlier.
It's like
the Uncanny Valley, or is that what they call it when you start?
Yeah,
to,
something
it,
like
it
that.
So
it's somewhere
realistic that
in
it
between.
Is off.
Yeah, and so I know you saw it in the regular projection, and I'm just wondering if you picked up on any of this or if this you had a completely different, purely visual experience.
I'm guessing I had a different, purely visual experience. As you said, mine was in 3D, and I don't think that added to the film at all. There were many times where I was watching and you would see a character and it's so clearly in 3D that they are completely cut off from their background. It looks like just a big head and shoulders completely separate from their environment. And I would look at that sometimes and wonder, why? Why do I have to see it that way? Why is this calling attention to itself in this way and completely distracting me from what I'm looking at? So the 3D didn't add anything for me here, but it doesn't sound like it was nearly as distracting as it was for the 48 frames per second folks.
Well, here's my question then, because I did enjoy all those other elements of the film that I talked about, yet I clearly had this presentation getting in the way. So is it fair of me? How much am I supposed to hold that against the film? I mean, I've honestly been struggling with it because if this was the only way to see The Hobbit at 48 frames per second, I don't think I could give it a positive review. Mm-hmm. I was only able to look past it figuratively, not literally, because I knew that the majority of theaters in the country are going to be projecting it traditionally. At the same time, I couldn't make it to a second traditionally projected screening. I really wanted to make the comparison. So I don't know that I would enjoy it that much more, but I was kind of making this, inventing this positive experience for myself that I couldn't have because of the projection. And the other question is this like, are we having a conversation that's similar to what was happening with the advent of sound or color, where we just need to catch up to this reality, or is this just really bad technology?
That is the question. And until more people see it in 48 frames and until that becomes more common, I don't think there's really any way we can know. You're absolutely right. It's going to have to be something that becomes a little bit more widespread. I do want to bring in our poll results from last week because you're giving Peter Jackson a pass here, despite the fact that the visuals were clearly his decision and his decision alone. But last week on the show, when we posed our poll question and we said, hey, Guillermo del Toro was originally attached as the director of this project, and then Peter Jackson took it back over. Is that a good thing for you? Are you glad that Jackson's back, or would you rather seen what Del Toro did with the project? We both said we would have rather seen what Del Toro did.
Right.
And It turns out 67% of our listeners also voted for Del Toro, and I certainly don't want to judge the film I would have rather seen. I'm looking at the film Jackson gave me, but I think this gets to this issue of never really getting swept up in the story. As I think about that poll, I wonder if Del Toro would have been able to find a way to bring some of the fear and dread to it that you get in his other films that I think The Hobbit needed, something beyond just the spectacle that Jackson gives us, because that's what I really think we get, is just the spectacle. I do think that this is cartoonish in a bad way, cartoonish without the sight gags and clever humor. The 3D, which I touched on, wasn't very good, and the CGI combines to make it look so artificial that in the fight scenes in particular, I didn't really feel it sped up at times, but there are a lot of fight scenes and no real sense of danger to them whatsoever. The technology here just makes it seem so fake that it actually reminded me of the sequences in King Kong. Sequences that otherwise derailed a pretty good Peter Jackson film, or a movie I thought that was pretty well on its way to being a good Peter Jackson film. Those are the ones with the dinosaurs and the big bugs, and they're just shooting guns everywhere. It's just total chaos. A lot of splatter, a lot of pretty colors and chaos, but no real wonder or investment. And that's a little bit how I felt watching The Hobbit.
Yeah, I don't know. Like you said, it's hard to say. I think those are the strengths of Del Toro, and he would have punched those up. I also would say that those elements of dread and fear are very much in the Gollum sequence I talked about. So I do feel that there is that sense in The Hobbit.
Small part of the film, though, overall. I will also say,
yeah, and what it revealed to me when I think about, you know, why I was more excited about Del Toro taking it on is because of the possibility of something new. And I think what this just revealed to me is maybe I'm just, you know, not one of those Hobbit fanatics. I never really thought I was, but I did really love the Lord of the Rings films beyond what I probably would have guessed. And maybe The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, is just showing me I've sort of had my fill of this.
Well, on that note, The Hobbit is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Admittedly, they're not the Oscars, but we're proud to say they're not the Golden Globes either. We share the 2012 Film Spotting Golden Brick nominees next. Stay with us.
Oh, no. I didn't know what it means to believe. Oh, my. I didn't know what it means to believe. But if I hold on tight, is it true? Would you take care of all that I do? Oh, Lord, I'm getting ready. Oh my, I didn't know how hard it would be. Oh my, I didn't know how hard it would be. But if I hold on tight, is it true? Would you take care of all that I do? Oh Lord, I'm getting ready to believe. Then we'll be waving hands, singing freely, singing standing tall, now coming easy.
It's thank you time here on Film Spotting, where we recognize our very generous donors, the people who keep Film Spotting doing what we're doing. But first, we have a couple of notes. We wanted to mention our featured music this week. Coming out of the first break, you heard from the Lumineers, and in this break, Michael Kiwanuka, who I think we played very recently on the show back during our discussion of Superfly, the second film in our Blaxploitation marathon. And the reason we featured those artists this week, Josh, ties into the Golden Bricks, where we consider sometimes movies that listeners say they never would have seen or even heard of if it wasn't for Film Spotting. So on the Film Spotting Facebook page, I asked listeners to weigh in with an artist or a musician that they had never heard of and are now a big fan of because they heard them on Film Spotting. And we got a wide array of answers, but two of the names that stood out the most were the Lumineers and Michael Kiwanuka. The Lumineers have become huge now. Their song Ho Hey is on the radio all the time, and it was in the Silver Linings Playbook trailer. But a lot of people noted that we were the first place they had heard the Lumineers. We have to give Sam
we'll
Van
take
Hallgren.
Credit. So, oh, Sam will take credit.
Sam okay, will take credit. Yeah. He deserves it. He's the music guy here on Film Spotting, the true music snob out there. So thanks to everyone who weighed in with their answers and who sends us great musicians to feature here on the show. We have shared a lot of your favorite artists on Film Spotting, and we will continue to do so. Have to mention as well our holiday T-shirt sale.
Yes. How's it going?
This started 2 or 2.5 weeks ago, somewhere around there. Somewhere around Thanksgiving, I put up that we had 75 T-shirts left, and I want to move them all by the end of the year. And as of this moment, we're sitting here right now, Josh, I think we're down to 18.
Not bad.
So we have moved a lot of shirts.
Now, how about this? I'm sure they'll all go, but if they don't, if by chance they don't, mm-hmm. can we get one of those T-shirt cannons they have at like Chicago
For
Bulls
the live
game?
Show?
Bring it to the live show and just spray the audience with, you know, the 3, 4, maybe 5 that people don't buy.
I like where your head's at, but I'm not sure we've got the budget for
no.
it. I think those
costs more
expensive.
Than the T-shirts.
I think, yeah, a lot more.
Probably right.
Than the T-shirts. But there are still shirts available, though you're running out of options. There are now only brown and black left, and I don't believe we have small or medium. Maybe not even large. Actually, no, just small and medium. So anyway, the inventory is dwindling. And the prices are now lower for our holiday sale. So if you want a chance at a shirt, and we will try to get it to you by Christmas. We're at that deadline that maybe, depending on when you're hearing this, we might not be able to get it there. But we'll certainly try to get it out as fast as we can. You can go to filmspotting.net and click on the T-shirts link there. It's there in the top stories and also under About Us. So thank you to everyone who's ordered a shirt. I think we're close. I think by the end of the year,
we're going to do it. Huh?
I think we're going to do it. I'm optimistic, Josh. We also want to give some thanks and a plug to our buddy Jeff Goldsmith over at the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, his podcast that features great interviews with screenwriters. Every week you can find something new there, and we'll link directly to his show page in our notes at filmspotting.net, or just do a search for the Q&A in iTunes. That brings us to our donors, and we start with a new $10 a month subscriber.
That would be Clyde from Greensboro, North Carolina.
We also have a new gold-level donor from Canada.
That would be John, Guelph, Ontario, actually.
Indeed. A new $5 a month donor. Actually, two new $5 a month donors.
Matthew in Los Angeles, California, and Jason in Woodstock, New Brunswick, Canada.
Thank you very much, guys, and to everyone who is a monthly donor of Film Spotting. Two new Silver Club donors, Charlene in Detroit and Wendy in Santa Monica.
This is my second donation in the past year. I discovered Film Spotting in 2011 and rapidly became a devotee. After listening to your recent show on the top 5 pets in film with my pug, I figured I'd had to give you a few more bones, as it were, especially after hearing your musical tribute to my absolute favorite Christopher Guest film, Best in Show. I realized that I had to pay you my tribute. It's nice to know you're not above singing an ode to terriers to earn your proverbial supper. I think we'll sing about other breeds if there's a donation in it.
For the right amount. We can be convinced to do just about anything, but God loves a terrier. That's all I can say. We also want to thank two final donors this week, Kyle in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Matt in Tinley Park, Illinois.
I've been a Film Spotting listener for over 5 years now, and this is my first donation to the show. Being a poor college student is really what has hindered me from donating sooner, but being that it's the holiday season, I thought this would be the right time to pay up in whatever small way I can. It's even more appropriate that I donate, considering I'll be graduating this weekend. During the spring, I had the opportunity and pleasure to work with Adam on a project I had to complete as a graduation requirement. I can't imagine what the finished product would have looked like if someone else were in his place. As a longtime listener, it was a real treat to sit down with the man himself. Yeah. Adam, consider this
It's a real treat when people get to meet the man himself.
The man, the tutor, the legend.
Uh-huh.
Adam, consider this a small thank you for your help on my way to earning my degree. I'd also like to say happy holidays to both Adam and Josh. Keep doing what you do, guys.
Thanks, Matt. That was a lot of fun, actually. I got a chance to go and talk about a film I love, The Long Goodbye, and participate in a Q&A session after that here in the Chicago area. So thank you, Matt, for getting me involved in that and for your donation to the show and your support. Matt's also one of the listeners who was turned on to Michael Kiwanuka from listening to Film Spotting. So we get to go full circle here in the donation segment. Our thanks again to everybody for your generosity this past week.
Looking down, honey, can't you see? Oh Lord, I'm getting ready to leave. We'll be waving high, singing freely.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting. being in the house, mum out in the pub, mum comatosed in bed and setting fire to the bedroom to keep my brother and sister warm because it was cold.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's a scene from The Arbor, the experimental documentary from filmmaker Cleo Barnard about the tragic life and times of British playwright Andrea Dunbar. It was our Golden Brick winner for 2011. It was the film we chose to champion with our Golden Brick Award. And we're going to get in now to the nominees for this year's Golden Brick Award. And of course, we probably need to set up a little bit, Josh, what the Golden Brick is or what we're looking for.
This is no easy task
either. Naming these nominees. No, it is difficult because the object keeps changing a little bit. This is the fourth year of the awards and we're still trying to define it. And I'll be honest, I think now in its fourth year, we've finally defined it. I think we've finally gotten to what the Golden Brick should stand for. And as we get to these eight picks here, they all have in common that we think they're good films and they were not widely seen by audiences. Some played in more theaters than others, but none of these picks really even had the chance to be seen by wider audiences because they got limited releases and runs. And if you look back at our previous winners, like The Arbor, the Greek film Dogtooth before that, Duncan Jones' film Moon, the inaugural winner, and then the movie that inspired the award, Rian Johnson's Brick, you will see some other patterns start to emerge. They tend to be movies that are artistically ambitious, movies that take chances or at least reflect a unique directorial vision. We also tend to favor new filmmakers who are not widely known yet. We're trying to shine a light on directors who show a lot of promise and potential and are worth keeping an eye on. There are exceptions. You're going to hear at least two exceptions to that rule here in a moment. So they're not hard and fast rules, but that is a factor we consider anyway. We also like to have a mix of movies that we reviewed on the show and movies that we ourselves overlooked throughout the year or were only able to see finally at the end of the year. So you're going to get titles that you probably haven't seen and maybe have never even heard of, which is kind of the goal, actually, of the Golden Bricks, to expose you to movies that otherwise are completely off your radar. So did I set that up properly, Josh?
I think that hits it. Yeah, okay. I like it.
Okay, well, we settled on eight titles. We brought two in that we agreed on jointly, and then we have three individual picks. Why don't you get us started with the first of our two joint picks?
That's going to be Wuthering Heights, which we actually mentioned the last few shows. You saw it first. I caught up with it. We were both really impressed. It's an adaptation of the Emily Bronte novel, of course, the one about a doomed friendship turned romance between a girl and an orphan boy who's been taken in by her father on the moors of Yorkshire. It's directed by Andrea Arnold, who made Fish Tank, and she brings this tactile, earthy sensibility to it. We can almost feel the squishy mud in this movie or the smoke from the cooking fires. And the film also seems to be taking place right now, not in the distant past, even though it's very attentive to the period details, I think. They're very vivid, but it somehow seems to be contemporary at the same time. The overall impression to me was that this might have been what the story looked like in Bronte's mind as she was writing it, because she did live among these moors, and it just felt that alive to me. You can actually see it. It's in theaters right now, but it's very, very select. It's going to spread out slowly through the end of the year. The best place to find play dates is on the distributor's website, the Oscilloscope website. So we'll hopefully provide a link to that.
We will provide a link, and we'll also keep you informed as we progress here and we get closer to a DVD date or a digital rental date. We'll try to keep you informed on that, because there's no doubt Wuthering Heights is a movie I think more people need to see. Our next joint pick is the film that was the most popular answer when we asked listeners on Twitter and Facebook. What movie from 2012 did you see primarily because Film Spotting reviewed it and championed it on the show? And that's Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, a movie written and directed by Nuri Bilge Ceylan, a Turkish filmmaker, definitely a well-established filmmaker at this point. He's made six films, but I think he works in this scheme of our bricks because he's still a relatively new name to most listeners, I imagine. He just got on my radar a few years ago, and sadly, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia is still the only film of his that I've seen. So, as I said, a director who I think still needs to garner more attention here in the States. And a spoiler alert, there's a very good chance this movie is going to come up next week during our top 10 films of the year. So I'm going to be brief here. It's a slow movie. It's too slow for some. I've definitely heard that. Matt Singer complained about that on our sister show, SVU. I get that, because it's a film really about a police prosecutor and a commissioner and other officers looking for a body in the night. Someone claims that he murdered a victim, and he doesn't remember where he buried the body, and they're looking for it. And that search, that futile search, comprises the bulk of this film. So it's not heavy on plot at all, but I was mesmerized by it largely because of the cinematography. I also think it's got a very subtle, sly sense of humor that I responded to. And like many great artists before him, Jalon mines the mundane to great, profound effect. So I'm a huge fan of this film, and I really do hope more people get a chance to see it.
That's one we reviewed fairly early in the year, so it's nice to see that perhaps people did check it out and have now seen it, and it showed up when we asked the question.
And unlike Wuthering Heights, it's a movie that is widely available to people. If you haven't seen it yet, you can get it on DVD and Blu-ray. It's also available via Netflix instant streaming, and you can rent it digitally through iTunes. So a lot of different ways to see Anatolia, though I would recommend going the DVD or streaming route on your television and not necessarily the digital rental where you're watching on a computer screen.
The biggest screen you can find,
yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Well, we do try to recognize new filmmakers with the Golden Brick nominations, as you mentioned, Adam. But one movie by an established director that we both liked and was still somehow overlooked this year was David Cronenberg's Cosmopolis. Robert Pattinson of Twilight fame spends most of the movie riding in the back of a limo, taking meetings, making decisions as some sort of wunderkind CEO. It's bizarre, of course. I still think it should be illegal to conduct a prostate exam in a moving vehicle. But I also found it to be the most intriguing cinematic response yet to the 2008 financial crisis. Yes, Adam, I'm including Killing Them Softly. We both liked Cosmopolis, but we're fairly alone on this. The movie's scores aren't overwhelming at either Metacritic or Rotten Tomatoes. And when I looked it up to see its box office, I was pretty shocked, actually. Only $750,000 is what it made.
Wow. Yeah, when you initially brought this up as a Brit candidate, I thought, yeah, maybe it doesn't work because I felt like a lot of people like Cosmopolis, and it's David Cronenberg, so surely this is a movie that people sought out, or at least discerning cinephiles sought out, and maybe they did. To the effect of $750,000.
Yeah, that's about it.
That's it, unfortunately.
And the tough thing is it's actually in limbo right now. It's not going to be available on DVD till January 1.
You have 9 new voice messages. First voice message.
Hi, Colin. It's your favorite sister, JR, calling. Give your sister a call back. I need your help this weekend, so give me a call.
Message erased.
I think we wanted to go down there and concentrate on the breeze and the pina coladas and not your emotional turmoil and your pathetic, shambled life.
You're such a jerk.
Next message.
Well, we go from Cosmopolis and the very well-established David Cronenberg to another young director, a second-time filmmaker here with my next Golden Brick nominee, and it is The Color Wheel. Actually a 2011 film, but it wasn't distributed until this past year, and it's the second feature from Alex Ross Perry after his 2009 film Impolex, which I have not seen. But essentially, this is a movie where he plays a character named Colin, the brother to JR. She invites him, despite their somewhat fractured relationship and sibling rivalry, to go with her to collect her belongings from the apartment where her former lover and former professor lives. It's shot in black and white 16mm that looks somehow just like so many great Jean-Luc Godard films that I've seen, including Masculine Feminine. There are some shots of the lead actress, Carlin Altman, just putting lipstick on in the bathroom of a gas station that I want to take out of the film and frame them on my wall. There's just something so striking about the look of this film. One thing that is hard to get past with this movie is that Alex Ross Perry does sound exactly like Michael Cera when he talks. Doesn't look like him, but sounds exactly like him when he speaks. And yeah, that can be a little bit disorienting, but I think Altman is a real discovery. And as characters, they're both so vulnerable and simultaneously sweet and combustible with each other that it does make for a really fascinating dynamic. I've actually had a fairly long email exchange with longtime listener and the host of the Cinephiliacs podcast, Peter Labuza, about this movie, specifically arguing about it in relation to the Tim Heidecker movie, The Comedy, because they're similar in that they're both largely observational films about unpleasant people. You could certainly have that response to The Color Wheel. He much prefers Color Wheel. I'm a fan of both, but Color Wheel is definitely a much lighter film than The Comedy, much more overt humor to it. It's really just a road trip comedy with two siblings, so it's not as challenging a film overall, but it does have a scene that I would argue is way more challenging than any of the disturbing scenes in The Comedy put together. The most disturbing scene I watched all year.
Wow.
In cinema, and that's all I'm going to say about it. Don't read anything about The Color Wheel. Just watch the movie. You'll either thank me or hate me later for it. And the only way you can do that is by renting it digitally from Amazon or iTunes. But it is out there for rental if you want to see it.
Well, unlike The Color Wheel, which most people probably haven't even heard of, a lot of folks heard of my next film, Beasts of the Southern Wild, but not nearly enough have seen it. This is the Sundance sensation about a young girl who's struggling to survive with her father in a post-Katrina Delta community. And because of that Sundance success, we debated a little bit about whether or not this was too big. It certainly did have a fair amount of critical support, but it also had a lot of naysayers, too, some pretty strong naysayers. So the critical response was awfully divided. As a matter of fact, it gave us the chance to have A.O. Scott of the New York Times on the show to spar with his old partner, our own Michael Phillips, because they diverged on it. Now, when I've been asked by people about my 10 best of the year lately, and spoiler alert, Beasts of the Southern Wild is going to be fairly high on that list. When I mention Beasts, they kind of either get a confused look or they tell me, oh, yeah, I meant to see that. I just didn't get around to it.
Actually, behind your back, we're all mocking you.
That could be too. Get around to seeing it. You really need to see this film. Whether or not its mixture of fairy tale, fantasy, and social realism works for you, it's going to be one of those unforgettable movie experiences. You're not going to go out shrugging your shoulders. It is available on DVD right now through Amazon only, I believe, but it can be streamed or purchased for rental at about six other services. You can check those at Can I Stream It fairly easily.
Yeah, and while I didn't like the film as much as you did, I definitely did have a positive response to it overall, and I'll put it this way. We have to vote in our Chicago Film Critics Awards for most promising filmmaker. And I was going through the list of nominees, and I saw that there were young directors whose films I liked more or have ranked higher than Beasts of the Southern Wild. But I still had to give my number one vote to Ben Zeitlin.
Yep.
Just on the basis of all those names and all those films, who's the one filmmaker, based on the vision you see in that movie, that you most want to see what he or she will do next? It has to be him.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, too. Yeah, well, what you're most anticipating.
That brings us to our last three Golden Brick nominees here on Film Spotting. We're sharing our candidates for our Golden Brick Award, which we give out every year to the one film we most want to champion as the movie that was overlooked and underappreciated from 2012. We will announce that Golden Brick winner at our live show on January 6th at Main Stage. One of those candidates is a movie like The Color Wheel, was made in a previous year, but only just came out in 2012, and it's a movie I saw in 2009 back at the Toronto International Film Festival. It played the Midnight Madness program there and won that award. It's called The Loved Ones, and it's a horror movie, which I really wanted to give some love to here because I don't often enough give love to horror films. And how you sum up The Loved Ones best is the way a Toronto Film Festival programmer did then, which is, it's what happens when you merge misery with Pretty in Pink.
That sounds great.
Yeah, and it really is, because it's the story of a guy named Brent who gets asked to the prom by kind of the outcast girl named Lola, and he says no, and she doesn't take that too well and forces him to come to her private prom party with her father at their house.
Oh my.
And it is full of squirm-inducing scenes, but more because they're uncomfortable than disgusting. The director here, Sean Byrne, is a first-time filmmaker with this project, and you can really tell that he's someone to watch moving forward. I think he's someone who would be great in this genre, but you can tell that he's got enough talent overall that I think he can make just about any kind of film. There are some great jolts from scary moments, those kind of jump out of your seat moments, and a really smart use of camera. And I do think overall as well, it does what too few horror films do, which is allow you to invest in the characters so you want them to stay alive and get away. And you even kind of sort of just a little bit understand the fractured psyche of the damaged girl who loves him and shows it in the worst possible ways. I'm not saying you forgive her or that you like her much, but you do get a little peek in. And that little bit of empathy does go a long, long way. And I give Sean Byrne a lot of credit for that. So The Loved Ones is available via digital rental from Amazon and iTunes. And one of the things I mentioned to Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore when they brought it up on a recent Streaming Video Unit podcast was, I'm curious how it plays on that small screen, because he does some interesting things with the frame, including near the end of the film, there's a great visual joke that relies on the entire frame. When I saw it at Toronto, the humor comes from a character's position in the frame. in the expanse of the frame. And I wonder, seeing it on that little screen on your laptop or your TV even, is that lost a little bit? I'm not sure, but it's definitely a movie I hope more people see.
I'm glad we got some horror in there, because we thought about maybe Cabin in the Woods. That didn't really take off, yet still seemed too big. So
yep.
Nice. I'm going with a documentary for my last pick. A lot of worthy docs are being talked about this time of year, but I haven't heard much discussion of Eugene Jarecki's The House I Live In. This is his assessment of the fallout of America's 40-year war on drugs. It mainly starts with Nixon's coining of that phrase. And the thesis here is that this war has largely been ineffectual because it's put the focus on incarceration rather than rehabilitation. Jarecki's ace card here is the unlikely sources that he finds to make this argument, including a security supervisor at a prison. This guy's hardly a bleeding heart liberal. He has one quote at some point where he says he prefers to see 10 prisons than one soup kitchen, something like that. Yet at the same time, he gives this very reasonable, logical assessment of the prison industrial complex as this self-fulfilling prophecy.
I think a long time ago, we made drugs into this huge thing, and we've made it so illegal, and we've made it such a national issue with that tough-on-crime stance. I mean, you can't get elected if you don't profess to be tough on crime.
First, we have to join together to ensure that drug dealers are punished swiftly, surely, and severely.
You can't stay elected if you don't do things to be tough on crime.
It's to toughen sentences, beef up law enforcement, and build new prison space for 24,000 inmates.
You know, nobody can afford to be the first guy to say, wait a minute, we can't afford what we're doing, let's do something different. Because if you even made a noise like you were going to be soft on crime in any way, you would be out of a job.
So to hear it coming out of this guy's mouth is pretty powerful. I think Jarecki also made a brave choice in tackling this issue now, because it's not exactly hot. We don't hear a ton about the war on drugs these days. And I think it resonated for me, partly because of our Blaxploitation marathon, to be honest with you. A lot of these interviews are with real-life priests, the character from Superfly, or Tommies, the character from Black Caesar. They're now in prison. They're watching their sons, which are the kids from Cooley High, follow the same pattern in their lives. So there was a lot of resonance there that was really kind of awakening to me. The House I Live In puts much of the blame for all of this on public policy, and it really does make a convincing case. It's in extremely select theaters. They're kind of doing almost a city-by-city showing of it, from what I understand right now. I do know it's scheduled to be at Chicago's Gene Siskel Film Center on January 18.
We'll obviously link to more information about that as we get closer to that date. I'm also a fan of that documentary, and you're right that there are a lot of other documentaries getting way more attention. I'm guilty of that myself, because I can think of five or six docs this year that I really like, and probably like better, frankly, but I still think The House I Live In is one that deserves a lot more attention than it's getting. I was turned off a little bit initially by Jarecki's decision to make it personal.
Yes,
I was wondering how he was going to find a way to make it as expansive as it needed to be and as interesting and as in-depth, but also doing that common documentary trait of making it kind of about himself. But I'll be honest, I think he makes it work for the most part. I really do. And I also think that he does manage in about a two-hour film to sum up the past 40 to 50 years of drug policy about as well as you'd expect. So The House I Live In is definitely a good pick for a Golden Brick nominee. And I wish I could say I had planned this. That would make it sound better. In fact, it's just serendipity. My final Golden Brick nominee is a movie about a character dealing with his recovery from drug addiction. It is Oslo, August 31st, the second film from Norwegian director Joachim Trier. He made 2006 film Reprise, and this is essentially 24 hours in the life of Anders, who is just being released from a rehab facility. He has a job interview, but otherwise doesn't really seem to have much on his plate for that day. But after seeing how it begins, we have sort of an uneasy feeling about where it could be going. And I think we've seen this story so many times before about an addict starting over or an addict in recovery, but I don't think we've seen it like this. It just doesn't have the anger, the hostility, or the cynicism, despite its bleakness, that a lot of those films seem to have. And I know it's not a fair comparison, Josh, but I'm going to make it anyway. If you were bothered by the phoniness, and I would use the word phoniness, of much of Silver Linings Playbook and the way people dealing with mental disorders are depicted in that film, I'll just say Oslo is a perfect response to that, because there's nothing phony about the way it's depicted here. I think it's a film that is very haunting. And I use that word as much of a cliche as it is because I think Anders emerges as a ghost making his way through this day that should be the first day of the rest of his life. It should be a new beginning, but is really a trek through his past and all the relationships and all the opportunities he squandered along the way.
See, I was going to go and say how much I agree with you, and you had to take a shot at Silver Linings
Playbook. Had to go for it.
I have room for both approaches in both films, Adam. I do really like Oslo. I also like Reprise, and being partly Norwegian, both films worry me that this is national character, this sort of moroseness and mental instability. I'm trying to look past that, but this is a very interesting film.
Well, I want to share one note in closing here from a listener. Levi Chapman in Dallas, Texas recently wrote us in and wanted to thank us for mentioning the film on a recent show because it had a big impact on him, and he ended up writing an analysis of the movie for a film class. He says, "The film allowed me to realize that my struggles and problems in life are always within the context of a struggling world, filled with individuals who are met with the same problems and obstacles. It warned me to guard against the self-imposed isolation that is often the byproduct of self-absorption and self-pity. The protagonist fails to view his struggles within the context of those around him, and as a result, crumbles under the pressure of those struggles. That's just one particular reason why I love this film, and I'm thrilled to hear you guys championing it on the show. I'm glad he used our favorite word there, champion. That is the point of The Golden Bricks. And if you want to see Oslo August 31st, it's available on DVD and Blu-ray, also instant streaming via Netflix and Hulu Plus. You can also rent it on iTunes or Vudu. So a lot of different ways to see that film from Joachim Trier. Those are our 2012 Film Spotting Golden Brick nominees. Again, we'll announce the grand prize winner, the winner of the coveted Brick Award at our January 6th live show. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. And we do encourage you to please go to filmspotting.net and vote now for the nominee you think is most deserving of the Golden Brick.
You can also leave us voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, nobody is competing with The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey.
Do not see it at 48 frames per second.
You want to make it clear that you say see it if you can, but not in 48.
Not if you can help it. And you should be able to help it. I don't think a ton of theaters are going to be showing it at 48.
Opening in limited release here in Chicago, the new film starring Laura Linney and Bill Murray, Hyde Park on Hudson. I believe you reviewed this on your site. Not a recommendation?
No, that one's a chore. The Hobbit isn't a chore. Hyde Park on Hudson is a chore.
I watched the trailer for Hyde Park on Hudson, and I knew there was no way I was going to see it.
You made the right choice.
That completely turned me off. Beauty is Embarrassing, also opening. This is a documentary by Neil Berkley that is a documentary about the life and times of artist Wayne White. He got his start as one of the creators of Pee-wee's Playhouse, and I didn't know anything about Wayne White. I'm ashamed a little bit to admit, until I heard him and Neil Berkley a little while back on a WTF podcast with Marc Maron. And the film sounds very interesting, and Wayne White as an artist sounds very interesting. It's a movie I do hope to see here in the near future. And the near future is right now, Josh, because it's playing starting this weekend at the Gene Siskel Film Center. Next week on the show, it is our end of year roundtable with Scott Tobias from the AV Club and Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. We'll reveal our top 10 films of the year.
Is your list done?
My list is done, at least as done as I think it's going
to be.
No
revisions? You're not going to make retractions?
I don't know
that. Things around?
I don't know that I have the strength. We had to submit for the Village Voice poll.
Right.
A few days ago, the earliest I've ever had to submit a top 10 of the year. I think it was December 10th.
Yep.
So that was a shock to my system. But now that I have that in, unless I do see something that just is a huge revelation, my list is set.
All right. Okay. Mine too. I'm ready to go. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist, we had the music both of The Lumineers and Michael Kiwanuka. You can learn more at thelumineers.com and michaelkiwanuka.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.